Hello and welcome to Asking for a Friend. I've got my two hosts with me, Adam and Steph. Hi, Adam.
Hello, how are you, Louise?
Not too bad, thanks. How are you?
I am excellent. Yes, looking forward to this one. It's a subject I've thought about a lot, so looking forward to hearing what you guys have come up with.
Oh, good. And hi, Steph, how are you?
Hello. Yes, I'm really well, thank you. And hope you've had a lovely Easter holiday.
Yeah, I feel like something big happened that I was going to tell you, and now I can't remember what it was.
You went away for a bit, didn't you?
Oh, I know what happened. Joseph passed his driving test.
Yay, congratulations, Joseph.
Well done.
And now we're living on different timescales because he's out in his car all the time, doesn't even need the lift, so he goes out about tea time and doesn't come back until the yay middle of the night when I'm asleep.
Wow. How's he enjoying it?
Oh, he loves it. Absolutely. Just loves it. The freedom of your first wheels is brilliant, isn't it?
Mm. Yeah, it is.
Just before we get into anything, just by mentioning Easter, you've reminded me, do either of you two remember when we weren't allowed to buy Easter eggs until the Monday was over, and then we could go and buy all the half-priced Easter eggs?
Yes.
Was that a thing for you as well?
It was definitely one in our congregation. Adam, we're probably, because we went to the same congregation, we probably remember. I remember Bank Holiday Monday. I was never invited onto one, but I know that a few couples would go on like a road trip somewhere pretty on the bank holiday and go to a supermarket and get loads of half-price Easter eggs.
Yeah, I remember it well.
Yeah.
So who bought half-price Easter eggs this year?
No, I didn't do it. I just bought the full-price ones like a schmuck.
You didn't?
I did.
Steph?
On Friday night, they were still selling some Easter eggs on sale, some mini eggs, and they were half price, I think, in Tesco, so I got some mini eggs. But no, other than that, I didn't see much that was particularly good value for money. I think they'd only taken maybe 10-20% off in my local Tesco.
Tesco? Up your way as well, up north, in Yorkshire.
I know.
£40
worth,
half price.
Yeah. Wow. I'm trying to be good anyway, so giving me more chocolate's probably not a great idea.
Well, nice call, that one. So, we've all picked a topic that we're kind of interested in, that we want to talk about, what the real reason why some changes happened. Adam, what have you got?
So, I have done some research on the elder arrangement within Jehovah's Witnesses and why there was recently an adjustment made to the age limit for elders.
So tell us what the adjustment was first, and then what's the real reason?
So I've come with some background to the whole thing, just in case any listeners don't understand what elders are, etc. So elders are basically the stewards of a congregation. I don't know about you guys, but the congregations that I've been in, they tend to have between 5 and 10 elders, and they're basically the policemen. They organise the meetings, they keep an eye out for any bad behaviour, and then if you do something wrong, they're the ones who pull you up and punish you. I think that's a fairly accurate description, isn't it?
I think it is, yeah.
Yeah, and I think it's definitely the thing as a male, as a brother, you are supposed to strive to be. It's like the pinnacle of your career. If you stay local, you don't go to Bethel or whatever. Yeah, I think that's the highest accolade that men can aspire to.
Yeah, so if you were a child growing up in a congregation, if you were a male, as Steph rightly says, then you would be pushed towards becoming an elder at some point in your life. So back in the day, I think it was 1971, that was when the elder arrangement came in the congregations. So exemplary middle-aged or older men would be appointed to be elders. And my experience, maybe it's the same for you guys, but the three congregations that I'd been in, or the four congregations I'd been in, the majority of elders were in their 40s, 50s, 60s. They were kind of experienced men who had a bit of life experience, had families, and they'd had a number of years within the organization. They weren't people who were newly, freshly in. I think that's probably an accurate description.
Yeah, they were supposed to be like wise, weren't they, and stuff like King Solomon.
Yeah. And it was also, they all seemed to have wives, apart from the odd one who might be a bit of an outlier. They all seem to have quite squeaky clean lives in the congregation, but their kind of wives and their families were also really well respected as well.
Yeah, and I think when I was looking through some of the material, just what you've said there, Steph, is that that's actually one of the qualifications, that even if you were, say, a 45-year-old man who'd been in the organization for 20 years and you were exemplary and you did everything right according to the rules, but your wife perhaps didn't come to the meetings that often, or she maybe worked in a questionable work sector that the organization didn't like, then that might stop you from being appointed as an elder.
I definitely think it held back. I mean, obviously, naming no names, but DP, who was in our hall,
yeah,
I think that held him back for many years, because his wife was, she kind of faded, didn't she? And didn't attend meetings for many years. I don't believe she still attends now, but I think it took him twice, three times as long to be made an elder as it would somebody like JR, who was an elder.
Yeah.
Because his wife was a... because his wife was a pioneer.
Yeah, and I think that's... And most of the elders... Well, most of the elders that I came across were kind of 40 plus. I'd say there was occasionally one that was in the 30s. So this elder arrangement came into being in the early 1970s. And it's pretty much gone unchanged, apart from a few tweaks here and there, until recent years. So you guys will probably have had the experience where you've had elders come round to your house and give you advice or tell you off for something that you've done wrong. And usually it's two men that are much older than you are. So you kind of feel like you have to accept the advice and take the hit. I don't know if that rings true with either of you.
Yeah, definitely. I know growing up, I would say the average age of elders in our congregation, Adam, was probably 50, 55.
Yeah, I'd say so. I think very, very occasionally you get an elder who was in their 30s, but the majority of them, they're middle-aged. A lot of the ones in the congregations I've been in have been well into their 70s and even 80s sometimes. So it's generally an older man who's got life experience.
Yeah, I think I get the feeling that the younger elders were usually related to another elder or the presiding overseer.
Yeah, in my experience as well, there's an element of sometimes a face fits. And there would be a younger elder, you know, appointed if their family members were in good positions, etc. So what prompted me to look into this was that it was either early 2025 or late 2024, there was a letter sent to all congregations saying that elders can now be appointed at the age of early 20s or 21, 22. And it came as a bit of a shock to me, and probably a lot of other people as well, because the whole remit of an elder, the job of an elder is to sort of spiritually lead the congregation and keep it in check. And now they're saying that it's acceptable for a 21-year-old to do that. So it was quite a big change, I think. And it started me thinking as to what are the reasons for this, because it's quite odd that a job that you would require someone to have a lot of life experience for, you're suddenly saying, right, a 21-year-old can do it. So I don't know what you guys think, whether it came as a shock to you.
I mean, I think that when you understand that elders hold your spiritual life in their hands, that they can disfellowship you and cut you off from your entire family, friends, support network, and that you will be destroyed at Armageddon by their doctrine. To put that in the hands of a 21-year-old who may have had no life experience at all is quite terrifying.
Yeah, it is terrifying. I think it's shocking, but I think I can maybe hazard a guess at why they might have done it. I just think that Jehovah's Witnesses are not allowed, as we know, to have further education or have any kind of career. And I think it's a way of perhaps making up for the fact that there is no career progression of any kind that young men are going to be allowed in their lives, and that they're having to give, the governing body are having to give maybe a little bit and say, well, you can't go, you can't have further education, you can't have university, but you can still feel as though you're having some kind of career progression, because by 21, you should be on a kind of career path and starting to do well, you know, at something and progressing. So maybe it's that.
Yeah, I had similar thoughts to you, Steph. I went off on a bit of a tangent with another adjustment that happened recently, though. So if you just rewind about a year ago, there was another big adjustment that was made for men who are Jehovah's Witnesses, and that is that they were allowed to have beards. Now, we could do a whole hour on another podcast about this. For any listeners that are not aware, Jehovah's Witnesses having beards, especially in America and the UK, that was an absolute no-no.
Unless you were a woman, I think it was allowed. But if you were a man, you had to shave it.
Very funny.
Good, very good that. So yeah, if I'd have grown a beard, then I wouldn't have been given responsibilities and I would have been kind of soft shunned. So that maybe helps to explain to listeners the beard thing. So about 18 months, 2 years ago, they changed the policy on it and they said that men can now have beards without any repercussions. So I felt what that was that the governing body were looking at the amount of young men that they were losing from the organization and said, well, we need to lighten the, what would you say? We need to lift the lever a little bit on this, and we need to give them something back. So we've allowed them to, you know, to grow beards, etc. And then almost exactly 1 year later, they've made this announcement about appointing elders at the age of 21. So it makes me think that this is all driven by how many young men they are losing from the organization. And they're pulling a lever and hoping that works. But they're saying, right, we'll give it 12 months. We'll see if that works. And if it doesn't, then we'll pull another lever and we'll give that 12 months. And I think this is exactly what it is. I think the beards thing was massive for young Jehovah's Witness men. And they've given it 12 months and it's still not worked to the desired effect. And they've gone, right, we've got to lower the age for elders. So that's just my thought. I thought they're losing so many people. They had to do something about it.
I think it's definitely part of it, 100%. I also think that if we think about what it meant to be an elder back in the day, it was somebody who had to have kind of, they were seen as wise, weren't they? They were seen as knowing the Bible really well. They were seen as being spiritual leaders. But now that so much of the meeting and so much of the running order of things is just prescribed by Bethel, to a point where they watch so many videos and have JW broadcasting, I think that the very fact that when you are on the ministry, that most things are directing you to the website, you know, go to jw.org rather than having deep philosophical biblical discussions with people on the doors, which is how I remember doing the ministry. I think it's just that the kind of mental requirement and the educational side of things is that there's no sort of lower age limit that's necessary anymore, because it's literally, are you male? Are you within decent standing? And can you parrot whatever it is that the governing body has prescribed?
Yeah, I would agree with that. So what we're saying really is you could get a robot to do it with very basic programming.
Yeah, as long as he has a penis, then there's absolutely no reason why he can't do it.
I would agree with that. Years ago, I used to work in a shoe shop as a shop assistant, and there was a shop manager. And what I realised very quickly was she had absolutely no autonomy at all in any of the running of the shoe shop. She was hold everything that she had to do, which shoes she had to put out, where to place them, everything. And I think she got paid like a tiny bit more. And actually, I just wonder if the elder arrangement has gone a little bit like that now, because as you say, Adam, so much more is directed that it needs a lot less autonomous thinking around it. And therefore you can have, and because they have the elder's handbook, which really lists everything out, doesn't it? Literally every single thing. Although they always had that before as well, but I think because there's a drain of men, perhaps, that they've had to lower the age to try and keep the body of elders as a body and not as just a few old timers.
Yeah, I think there's some truth in that, Louise. And I think as well as there being a drain of men, I think a lot of young men have left and are still leaving the organization. I think there's also a lot of men left in the organization that just refuse to become elders. I know, like I was one of them. They talked for years about appointing me as an elder, and I just wasn't interested. I didn't want the stress and the pressure of it. So I guess there's quite a lot more like me that just don't want the hassle.
I can definitely see that. And I could also see, because they are leaving in droves and younger people are the most likely to leave right now, they have the most access to social media and further education beckoning, etc., that the governing body is doing anything that they can to give them any sort of responsibility. It's like you say, it's making people, giving people almost pointless promotions just so they don't leave.
Yeah, and it makes me wonder, maybe you guys have wondered as well, they've pulled a few levers here in the space of two and a half years. What's the next one? Are they, at some point down the road, are they going to allow women to be elders? Can you imagine?
Trans people.
Yeah.
But not women.
I think they are, it's like we touched on it on the last podcast, didn't we? I think there is going to be something that involves more women, because I think legally, with the abuse cases and the horrific way that it's so male oriented, I think they'll have to relax in some ways, but I just can't see them having the humility that it would take to allow, God forbid, a female to make decisions in the Kingdom Hall to that extent.
Yeah, I agree. I can't see that. So we think the real reason for the lowering of the age is pretty straightforward, that it's just a numbers game, that young people are leaving and that older people are getting older, and perhaps the congregations are getting smaller and there's just not enough men to go around.
Yeah, absolutely. And also, Steph raised a really good point about everything just becoming, I don't know if the phrase is dumbed down, but...
I think it is dumbed down. I think that's fine as a phrase, yeah.
When we were in the organization, we were used to discussing like really deep scriptural theories and ideas and prophecies in the Bible and stuff like that. And today, like Steph says, it's just a case of they point people to the website and they don't really have any kind of in-depth conversation. So I think that's an element of it too.
I would also say one more thing that I think would affect it is, I don't know what it was like in your congregation, Louise, but I think for the congregation that Adam and I grew up in, being an elder, being chosen to be an elder, was also really closely attached to how well your family was received in the congregation. So how good your wife was she a pioneer? If you were a decent brother and your wife was a pioneer, you were definitely more likely to be made an elder. And I think maybe now it's trying to attract young brothers who might not necessarily be married. So it's not giving any room for perhaps having an unbelieving spouse or having a wife who might have faded. I think that anything that impacts their chances of making elders, that they're trying to remove those blocks.
Just on a side point, can either of you ever remember when a young single elder visited your hall and gave a talk? The excitement amongst all the single sisters.
Yeah, I can, yeah.
I mean, yes, and I can remember in my congregation, there was a brother who arrived at the Kingdom Hall once, and my sister was so hell-bent on setting me up with him, and I just wasn't interested whatsoever, that she went, she did some research to find out if he was already married or not, and I was, please don't do this, just please don't.
So, Steph, what had you looked up for this week?
So I've got to give massive props to Paul Grundy for this, because I've been on JW Facts and I just think he sums it up the best. So I am stealing a lot, I must say, for this. I'm looking at why the Tuesday book study, or the whatever day it was either a Monday or a Tuesday for me, I don't know what it was for you two, but why the book study arrangement ended in people's homes. Now, this came in around 2008, January 2008, the book study arrangement ended. And I don't know about you, I don't know what you two think, but it was the least favourite of all the meetings in the week. I don't know what you think.
I would say I quite enjoyed it.
Your house, your family hosted it though, didn't it? To me, it always felt like you're having to get in the car just to go out for an hour and come back. But it ruined your whole evening. I didn't like the book study. I don't know what were you like, Louise? Louise, what was it like for you, the Thursday book study? Did you enjoy it?
I enjoyed the Tuesday book study. Because I was an only child and we didn't get out a lot or mixed in a lot, it was going to someone's house and I really liked it. And it was a short meeting, so it was my favourite. And when I was little, I could scrum about on the floor, and we used to go to John's bed house. And I used to scrum about on the floor, and then I used to really quietly roll underneath the sofa. And then up there is sofa. It must have been on legs. There was like a little fabric flap, and I used to pretend it was a shelf, and that I had jars of jam on the. So I just got lost in my own little world and just dead sofa.
Oh, but that's good. I mean, I'm glad you have good memories of it. I just found it utterly pointless and boring. And then this arrangement came in, but it wasn't until a couple of years after I had already left. So I left in about 2006, 2007, and then this arrangement came in 2008. And the society sold it to Jehovah's Witnesses as this is a loving arrangement, and that it was strategic because, number one, the brothers were concerned that families were having to pay too much in petrol. It was supposed to be a cost-saving exercise. It was also supposed to be an exercise where, rather than making families leave their house an extra night in the week, instead they should use that night, Tuesday night, Monday night, or whenever night the book study was, for family worship instead, so that they would have a Bible, a family study instead. And the other thing was that they incorporated the book study as part of the Thursday night, or what was known, the Theocratic Ministry School. So it was included as one of them. Now, that arrangement didn't last very long. It wasn't long before they completely got rid of the book study altogether. So I believe what I knew as the Thursday night meeting, the Theocratic Ministry School, the service meeting, it still kind of follows a similar format to that these days. What I knew as the Sunday meeting, being the public talk and the Watchtower study, is still that. But that the idea of the book study has now been completely disbanded. So I have my own ideas as to why they've done that, but I would like to know what your opinion is as to why they got rid of the book study.
Go first.
You go first, Louise.
I think, and I don't know if there's any evidence for this or if I've just pulled it out of my head or if I've read it somewhere, I think they got rid of the Tuesday book study because, well, I know for a fact in one case where a child was sexually abused in the home after the book study. And I think it's something to do with not being able to regulate things going on in people's homes and it being too much of a risk that children were going into other people's homes in a trusted environment, and that maybe there was more than one case of child abuse. Am I on the right track?
Well, is there a right or wrong answer? Because we know that the governing body will never give us the real reason. So I think with all of these, we have the freedom to speculate. But from what I've read online and from research that I've been doing, that is the general consensus, that this is absolutely one of the biggest reasons that people think the book study in people's houses ended. What about you, Adam? What do you think? There are a couple more, I think.
Yeah, I've thought about this quite a lot because I enjoyed the book study and I was really shocked when it ended. I was still in the organisation for a good 6 years after it ended. I never felt like I got to the bottom of why it really finished. Yeah, so a bit of me thinks
what Louise said about potential lawsuits coming up, abuse in homes, it was perhaps easier for some abusers to get away with it. The other thing about control, so there were kind of reports, and you did hear things occasionally, I heard things occasionally, where book study groups would go off at a tangent and...
They'd go rogue.
They'd go rogue and they'd start discussing things that the organisation didn't want them to discuss or speculate on. So I felt that maybe message control was a bit of a thing there. I also think another reason that perhaps contributed to it is for a book study group to function, you need a reliable company man elder to lead it. And you also need a reliable company man assistant, whether that's another elder or a ministerial servant, to lead it. And I just think in a lot of countries, they were starting to run out of reliable elders and servants quite a long time ago.
So I'm wondering whether that was... Maybe they do, if they'd reduce the age of elders to 21 back in 2008, maybe we'd still have a book study, I don't know.
Possibly. One of the things I really loved about the book study is it was at my mum and dad's house for a long time, and we used to clean the house before the book study, and I love cleaning. So my mum would give me the hoover, and she'd go, right, hoover the house. So every Tuesday evening, I would hoover the house from top to bottom, and that is one of the reasons I love the Tuesday book study. Sorry, got off at a tangent there.
Because I love cleaning, that's the thing of beauty, Adam.
It really is. It just is. Well, that doesn't surprise me from what I know of you.
It's just one of the things I remember is hoovering the entire house every single Tuesday, and I loved it.
Wow. Fair enough. No. Maybe that was one of the reasons that the society was sick of messy houses. I don't know, because, I don't know, you weren't there to clean them. You are all, I think, bringing up really good points. These are all points that have been discussed. Yes, the chance of a child being abused was much higher. And they wanted to make sure that there were never, there were as few reasons as possible for children to be involved in non-congregational, as in not at the Kingdom Hall, interactions with people. Another reason, I believe, is that some people were going rogue. I didn't know of that ever happening personally, but I do remember in our local book study that there were often times when it felt a little bit more light-hearted, and there were maybe some more nearer the knuckle jokes and things, even during the book study itself, not just afterwards, that might have been not appropriate for what Jehovah's Witnesses or the governing body would see as appropriate. The last reason that I've heard about is that Jehovah's Witness elders and the governing body were worried that there was possibly an insurance issue, that people who had opened their homes were not insured, and should anything happen, a fire or an accident of any kind, that they weren't set up for, or legally they hadn't registered people's homes as places of worship, and that this was another potential problem.
That's an excellent one, that I hadn't thought about the insurance issue. Yeah,
because I mean the society is really so litigious, and also people generally are more litigious than they used to be. Quite rightly so, or not. So the paranoia that the Watchtower has about being sued already, I think they just didn't want to open up any chances for that to happen.
Can either of you remember, for the majority of witnesses, why it came as such a big shock when it was dissolved?
I just remember being shocked. I mean, I'd left by then, so...
Yeah, I'd left, so I think you were the only one who really remembers it, Adam.
The things that were said to me, and this was said to me on a number of occasions, it was quite a hot topic of discussion for maybe a year, 2 years afterwards, was that the expectation amongst witnesses was that when they got nearer to the end of the system, to Armageddon, the end of the world, for any listeners that haven't maybe heard of that, is that they expected the government to kind of lock down or repossess the Kingdom Halls, and the only way that the witnesses could meet was secretly in each other's homes.
Yeah, so all of a sudden they've removed that.
Yeah, so a lot of people used to discuss that and say, we're really shocked because we thought that would be the last meeting to go, you know, the private one in people's homes.
Yeah, because that dystopian video where Armageddon's starting and they're doing that secret knock on the door and saying, oh, it's terrible out there, that's where they're all running into somebody's home, isn't it? And doing a secret knock on the door.
Is that the bunker video?
That's the one, the bunker video.
Bunker video, yeah.
I mean, I don't know. I think any one of those reasons is that we've talked about is legitimate, but I just think that it will have been shocking for a lot of people, because I think that is where a lot of the community feel of being a Jehovah's Witness happened, particularly when you had been in a book study group for a long time. I think that was where people probably had more of their one-to-one social interaction, and there was sort of, because it wasn't just the book study group, it wasn't just that night. You would join your book study group for field service on a Saturday morning. We didn't tend to meet as congregations. We met in our book study groups. We also cleaned the Kingdom Hall in our book study groups. It wasn't just meeting once a week for an hour. So I think a lot of people were sad, because for those who had close ties to those in their groups and had done for years, it maybe felt as though they'd lost that.
Yeah, I think it was a social club within a social club, wasn't it? And people liked the kind of intimacy of 15 or 20 people that you'd known for years. You know, you go to the person's house on a Tuesday night, and then after the book study you have tea and cake, and then you see them again at hall cleaning on Friday evening, and then again on Saturday for your ministry. So yeah, I think you're right, it's social connections.
Yeah, definitely. Thanks for that, Steph. I think probably nothing's just one reason, is it? I think probably all of those reasons were valid.
Yeah. And I think that, I don't know about you, but it was always a case of, it was a good book study if they did a brew afterwards. You know, like sometimes you'd go to somebody's book study group, maybe if you were visiting the congregation or you'd just gone to a different group for some reason. Maybe you had something on the Tuesday night, so you went to a Monday night book study instead. And then your group was used to doing a brew afterwards. And then there'd be that awkward pause after the study. And then they'd just go, right, well, see you later. Like, oh, they don't do brews here. I'm not coming here again. We always have a brew after hours.
Yeah, my mum was raging one time because she purposely didn't do a brew and cake very often. She'd just do it occasionally because she wanted her house back at 8:30. Let's face it, you know, if you've been busy all day, you want people to leave as soon as they can. And I think we had some visitors once and they said, I'll have a cup of tea then. And my mum's face was raging because she had no intention of serving the cups of tea that night.
Oh, my God. Oh, Mum. Right, well, I will wind up then with my real reason. And I've got case law behind mine. It's not just speculation. So I was looking at why the literature went free. And my memory is so bad. I thought it went free a lot sooner than it did, but it didn't. It went free round about 2000. I must admit, I thought it was sooner. And I remember practicing like how you offer the literature now that we can't ask for money for it. Does anyone else remember practicing that?
Just about. Yeah, we used Definitely. To say, we weren't allowed to say it was free. We had to say it was without charge or something like that. There was a phrasing to it.
There was definitely a point, wasn't there, when I was so used to saying they're just 30 pence for the two if you'd like to read the magazines. And then we were supposed to say, if you'd be interested in reading them, we'd like to leave these with you and then hope that somebody would say, how much is it?
Yeah. And I remember at the beginning when they first went free, there was some kind of tortuous thing where you sort of hinted that we'd value a contribution, but we couldn't ask for a payment. So the reason for all this was because of a court case in America where the Supreme Court ruled against Jimmy Swaggart, who was like a TV evangelist. And he had been selling literature like we were. He was also selling all sorts of other things as well. And the state of California, I think, took him to court and said that because he was charging, and I think he was getting a lot of money from his literature and all the other elements of his ministry, that they said that he wasn't exempt from the tax law of the state. So he tried to claim that he was exempt from the tax law of the state because if he was taxed, it would be an encroachment on his free speech. But the court said, well, you still can preach, like nothing's stopping you from preaching. We're not taxing your religious speech. We're taxing the sales of the literature and the other things that he was selling. So when it obviously, there was a ruling that then got appealed and then went to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court argued that that it wasn't an encroachment on his free speech and that the stuff that he was selling should be taxed. And as a result of that, so that was Swaggart Ministries versus Board of Equalization in 1990. But I think by the time the ruling came in the Supreme Court, it was a bit later. And then after that, the Watchtower then started making all their literature free, starting off in America and then rolling it out to all the other countries. So that is the real reason. Now, the reason the Watchtower gave was, and I remember this, they said, we don't want anyone who may not be in a financial position to give a contribution so that they miss out on the vital life-saving information contained in our literature. And we thought, well, this means Armageddon's like coming really soon, because, you know, we're giving away the word free now, and it's so urgent that we get the good news out to everybody that we're just going to not charge for it. I mean, as it happened, the Watchtower Society still got the money for the literature, because what happened was we went to the book counter and we bought all those magazines, and then we just tried to recoup what we'd spent by asking people for a donation, or as in the past, by charging, which we would then use to buy the next lot of literature. So I don't think the society themselves missed out. I mean, we were told constantly, don't forget that it costs money to produce all this. So the rank and file were still paying. It's just that the general public weren't paying anymore, and therefore we weren't subject to the tax laws of each country. I don't know if anyone else has got any opinion on how they remember that going down.
I think that we stopped charging people a fixed amount, I think, in the early 90s. I'm pretty sure it was before 2000. The 2000 thing, I think, is actually when we stopped paying for it at the literature counter, and nobody had to pay anything. I only know because of where we were living at the time. And I know that by the time we'd moved to Anglesey, I think about 94, I think it was either coming in at that point or had already come in. I think it was before 2000. I think it was more early 90s that we stopped charging witnesses. We stopped charging the householder.
I definitely remember that. I definitely remember it being sooner than that. Because in 2000, I was kind of close to leaving. And it was well before that, I seem to remember.
Yeah, I think the confusion there is probably to do with there was no longer a price that we had to pay at the literature counter anymore, but the householder hadn't had a fixed amount to pay for a long time.
Right, that makes sense, yeah, because I definitely remember being fully in, a full-on witness when I was practicing this. Asking for money, but not asking for money. And the difference between a fixed price and a donation being that a donation could be variable, so you couldn't really know what to tax on a donation. And donations go to charities, don't they? Whereas companies charge fixed prices for things. So what the court in California said, that we treat the sale of a Bible by Jimmy Swaggart as the same as the sale of a Bible by a bookstore. And I thought, yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, that's fair. Absolutely.
Yeah,
I
was just going to say, it was a strange old period, because I'm sure that in the few years preceding that, there'd also been a price increase. So the Watchtower and Awake magazines, which witnesses were well known for back in the day, I think they were maybe 20 pence each. And then they went up to 30 pence each or 40 pence each. And looking back, obviously there was a bit of a squeeze on printing costs by the looks of it. And the organization was looking for any ways it could to save money or pass the costs on to somebody else, i.e. us. I think they were in trouble maybe before that as well.
Do either of you remember going out on the ministry and selling subscriptions, like for certain months at a time, not just individual magazines?
Yes,
because there was a pink slip and a blue slip for subscriptions. And when I was looking on Reddit about charging money for magazines, people were talking about the subscriptions, and I always thought it was, although you got to report it on your time slip, it was a bit of a swindle, because once you'd sold a subscription, you didn't get the time to do the return visit every fortnight to sell your magazines.
Wow, I didn't know that. The end of subscriptions came in when I was still really, really young. I just remember being on the ministry one time with you'll remember Adam, a brother called Trevor, an elder in our congregation, and I had prepared an introduction, because like any good six-year-old Jehovah's Witness does with strangers, and I didn't get to do it because that day it was subscriptions only, and I wasn't qualified in any way to do a subscription.
Our family had a subscription. So with the subscription, you got the magazines before everybody else got them, before the main lorry load arrived in your area. And they used to come folded up in a brown paper sleeve with a postmark on it. And you kind of felt special because you got the magazines maybe a week or two before everybody else. So
subscribing for new content if you pay the premium.
Absolutely. We got the new content hot off the press. Yeah, we felt quite good about that.
Even though you were witnesses, so you got a subscription as Jehovah's.
Yes, yeah. So my dad, because my dad was like an uber witness. As long as I can remember, he had a subscription probably from when I was a child. And I remember it coming in the post, and it was quite exciting to sort of rip off the paper packaging and find out what the magazines were going to be.
Well, I subscribe to Private Eye, and I can tell you that that is a much more exciting subscription than the Watchtower.
I know I have the BBC History magazine. That's so much better.
So on Reddit, somebody had put about paying for the magazines. I was a kid in the 90s, and so I had no clue about this, as in about them being charged for. The idea of going out in service and reporting it was about reporting hours, screamed pyramid scheme to me, but I was thrown by the fact that I'd never seen them charging for literature. So I thought that was an interesting angle on it, that because we didn't charge for literature, we looked kind of more legit than maybe some more scammy fraudster type schemes.
I also think that generally people who are decent people, who are interested enough or feel sorry enough for us to have accepted the literature, would usually have made a donation. And I think that oftentimes they would get more for a donation than they would have done had they asked for a set price.
Yeah, I think that's true. I just used to hate the whole asking for money thing when it was a fixed price and when it was a donation. I hated it. And I still cannot ask for money. Like if there's a collection at work for somebody's birthday or something, I can't do it. I just cannot go around and ask people for money. My whole nervous system screams against it. I hate it so much.
I get that. I think that makes sense.
Yeah. One of the kind of offshoots of this is that if you were to take a snapshot of all the literature that was knocking about back in the early 90s, you know, there would be a day during the week where two of the congregation would go to the Kingdom Hall, and the lorry from the Bethel would load off all the magazines and the books, and there'd be tons and tons and tons of them. And you think of all the literature we took out in our ministry bags and sold to people, or later on just gave away to people. If you went into a Kingdom Hall now, you'd be quite hard pressed to find physical literature.
Yeah, one of the things that I found in my research was that the number of magazines has gone down, hasn't it? And has it reduced to like one a year or something?
Yeah, I think there's one Awake per year and one, possibly two, public Watchtowers per year. Yeah.
And if we think about Jehovah's Witnesses in their rank and file order of things, in this kind of organisational hierarchy, we were known as publishers. It was, and we just sort of absorbed it as part of the lexicon, but it's ridiculous to think that if you look back, they were a book printing company. That was what they were making their money off, and being known as publishers, they're still known as publishers today. But we've not published a single thing, personally. It was all based around selling books.
Yeah.
And it was, they even made a video. When they started making videos, I think the first one they made was about the Bethel operation and how it produced, you know, 20 million Watchtower magazines every month and all of these books. And it was all about how much literature they had out there and were getting out to people.
Yeah, I remember that. That was in the late 80s, early 90s. It was John Barr, wasn't it, who narrated it? He had that lovely Scottish voice. The organised to accomplish our ministry. It was a blue videotape. I remember that cassette tape, yeah.
It was VHS, wasn't it? It was back in the days of VHS.
Yeah, long before DVDs or anything like that.
Yeah.
God, how old are we? What I thought about all that literature, though, so in all honesty, when I used to go to the book room and pick up my magazines, I would buy the minimum I could because I could never place any. But the minimum was still more than I could place. And I would end up after a few months with a massive pile of literature that I hadn't placed. And then about maybe three times a year, I'd feel like super, super guilty. And I'd throw it out.
Yeah, because, yeah, but you were doing it wrong, Louise, because you should have gone to do what the sisters in our hall do, which is just go into a doctor's surgery or a dentist's waiting room and pass off all your literature there. That's what the pioneers would do.
Yeah. Or a laundrette, I know I should have, but I didn't. And I'd throw it out. And I used to think, even given the minimal amount that I bought and then threw out in big chunks once or twice a year, I thought if everybody across the country is doing that, the amount that was being sold to us compared to the amount that was being placed, I reckon, was massively...
We were the mugs, not the people taking it on the ministry. We were the mugs.
But do you remember that painful feeling that you would have as well when you would do a return visit and they would take the magazine and they would roll it up into a tube in front of you as you were talking and you wanted to say, I've paid good money for that?
Yeah, and also, do you remember that awful feeling you had when somebody had taken a magazine off you and you knew it was out of pity and you knew you had to go back and try and develop that interest? And I once placed a magazine and it was something about nature, and when I went back the person was really angry and they said, I thought this was about like World Wildlife Fund or something.
Wow.
That felt terrible.
We were having a conversation on text this week. I think Louise, you were the one who gave me the news. I had no idea about this, about the Watching the World segment in The Awake. Can you maybe remind us of that?
Well, do you know what? I'd really like to do a separate podcast about that because I think that is a massive story. And I think that is actually probably a good point to wrap this podcast up, but to say next time, let's talk about the whole Watching the World issue and the situation of the United Nations.
Spoiler alert.
The Guardian, I think, newspaper it was that broke the story. And we'll go through the whole history of that because it is absolutely fascinating. And it very quickly gets lost in the mist of time.
Yeah, because there's so much about just these discussions. There's so much about the organisation that we had no idea of. Even today, it surprises me. I had no idea about the Jimmy Swaggart reason. I thought it was probably a tax dodge, but had no idea about the history of my own religion.
Yeah, and I guess I would add as well, for any listeners to this podcast that are currently Jehovah's Witnesses, I know for us, or for me, definitely when I was in the religion, I didn't question anything I was told from the platform or in literature. I just accepted it. And it was only when I got to a certain point that I started to question it and find out the real reasons for things being changed or adjustments being made. So the advice from us is just ask yourself, what's the real reason for that change in the organization? Because what you're being told is not necessarily the truth.
Yeah, thank you for that. Yeah. Also, before we finish, I'd like to say I've managed to get all of our podcasts up onto YouTube as well now. So We're on Spotify and any podcast platform that you're on, and also YouTube. So I'll put links for that in the show notes. Thank you guys so much for all your research. That was a really interesting podcast. And next time, we're going to do an even more interesting one about the United Nations and watching the world.
This is amazing. We should start doing trailers, Louise, with dramatic music.
Yeah, we should. Little adverts, yeah. Do you know what, Adam? If I had nothing better to do, I would definitely do that. I struggle to even get my head around the limited amount of software that I use at the minute. So thank you, Adam, and thank you so much, Steph.
Thank you both.
Our podcast today. And thank you to our three listeners, the third one of whom emailed me and suggested that I put everything on YouTube, so I did.
Excellent. We know Tony Morris is listening as well.
Oh, he better be. Okay, thank you, guys. Bye.
Thanks,
bye. Diana. Bye now. It's not who you say.